not making it up himself. So for politics, for martial arts, for religiosity, there's one accepts a spiritual master. For learning the musical science, singing, musical instruments, one takes it from a teacher. So if one actually, the ultimate thing that we have to learn, obviously, how to learn to love Krishna, and that we need a very specific disciplic succession coming from Krishna himself, coming from outside of the material world. Yeah.
He mentions that Arjuna did the right thing by approaching Krishna as spiritual master and recognizing his bewildered condition. So Arjuna is like a classic Vedic hero. He does, you know, basically everything right. He asks all the right questions and so on. So how can a modern person identify? Because nowadays there are no heroes. There are, you know, anti-heroes. In the movies, the hero does everything wrong, basically. You know? So when a modern person reads Bhagavad Gita, he thinks, you know, this is some hero from a past age. What does it have to mean?
The confusion has to do with you. You are confused, and Arjuna was confused. You should become a hero by following the hero. I don't know if that's a good thing to tell them, but but the point Prabhupada explains in the purport so nicely, this is the position of every materialistic person, that despite all his you said bumblingness in one sense and all his mistakes, everyone thinks they're right, but yet everyone is deeply confused inside and they don't know what they should do. Modern life is so complicated, and that's becoming, it's becoming more clear that people don't know what to do and how to get out of the anxiety that they're in. So many psychotherapists, etc., people are becoming more in anxiety and more confused. So the simple route that Arjuna took to get out of his confusion is one that everyone in that sense can identify with, is that you approach, if you want to learn something, you have to approach somebody who knows. If you want to get out of confusion, you have to approach someone who is not confused. In India, of course, this is a fact that everyone accepts. And everyone knows that if you want spiritual knowledge, you have to approach a guru. In the West, people aren't, in one sense, as familiar with it. But yet, everyone knows that if you want to learn something, if you want to become a doctor, you go to school, you go to a teacher. You don't try to learn it on your own. But this, all this self-helpy, new-agey, touchy-feely stuff is really, it pushes things in the wrong direction. Because it pushes one from, it's very anti-authority. And this is one of the trends of Kali Yuga, that no one is an authority. There is no such thing as authority. And one difference between the Eastern or Oriental mentality and the Western mentality is that you see it when you're everywhere. As the difference is in the West, when something is powerful, the natural tendency is to want to knock it down and bring it down. And in the East, whether it's India or China, power people respect. When the truck goes rolling down the road, you move out of the way. It's natural, otherwise it will roll right over you. Any other questions? Yeah.
You mentioned that we should look out for Krishna.
Yeah.
See a little bit more about it, because sometimes somebody looks out, but he gets burned out instead.
He's what?
He's getting burned out instead of Krishna.
No, but his work should be not just going on according to his understanding, but it should be under the guidance of one who knows how to balance that working hard with the with the directly spiritual content of his life. It shouldn't be done haphazardly. The point being that he shouldn't not work. We are born generally in Kali Yuga with lots of passion in us. Lots and lots of passion. So that passion, we cannot stop being passionate. If I say from now on I'm not going to be passionate, I'm going to sit peacefully and chant 150 rounds of Hare Krishna every day. It's not that by that desire it's going to happen, because we're under the control of the modes of material nature. So the question is how to best use that passion. If we try to become renounced from work, that passion will attack us. Therefore, Krishna doesn't recommend the renunciation of work. Because if you try to be quiet and peaceful, what's the song by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur? What kind of Vaishnava, oh mind, what kind of Vaishnava are you? Patishtari, you are sitting alone in your Nirjan Bhajan. You know the Bengali? You know it? You're making believe that you are sitting alone in bhajan, in your worship, chanting Hare Krishna, but you're doing that just to, so people will say you're a great devotee, and all day long you're thinking of women and things like that. So not to renounce work, because we have passion, but rather we should use that energy in the service of Krishna very strongly, but as you're pointing out, in a balanced way, so that we become purified and Krishna conscious. That means under the guidance of those who know how to do that, the experienced devotees. But yes, we must work hard for Krishna, because the alternative is laziness, and that means ignorance, and ignorance means delusion and illusion and unlimited trouble for us. No laziness. Because passion, there's three modes. There's goodness, there's passion, and ignorance. Passion is actually closer to goodness than it is to ignorance. So passion can be converted nicely into goodness by becoming detached from the fruit of work. But we should not allow it to degrade into ignorance. Kama esha krodha esha rajagano samudbhava. We should not allow it to degrade into ignorance. Then there's no good that can come from ignorance, because the ignorance is opposite of good. Okay, I think that's time, so we'll stop here. So tomorrow we'll speak something about the third chapter. Forest Chimpopa. In the third canto of the Bhagavatam, Vidura, after inquiring from Maitreya Muni, tells Maitreya, after hearing some of his answers, that there are two kinds of people in this world who are free from misery. One is the great fool, who he compares, or Prabhupada compares in the purport, to a hog. Because the hog, especially if you've seen the pedigree hogs in Vrindavan and India, they're huge, they're fat, and they're ugly as anything, and they have their nose in the sewers, and they enjoy like anything in the sewers, with their little piglets following along behind them, completely covered in filth and horrible things, and stinking and being chased by the dogs and the people. And yet, somehow or another, they think that life is wonderful. But looking from a higher position, the higher position of human life, at these creatures, we are appalled, and we don't think it's wonderful at all. We think it's horrible. Yet they're happy. wallowing in the sewage, just in Vrindavan in the hot season, you see them and there'll be a big pit of sewage and they're in there just, you know, with their noses up, you know, just with their nose out of the water and just, it's pig heaven. So they're happy in complete illusion, in complete misery. And Vidura also explains that the one who is transcendental, beyond not only all misery, but beyond all material ways of thinking, he is also happy. So the hog-like human and the great transcendentalist are happy. And Vidura says, but everyone else in between is suffering. And that suffering for the devotee who is not either like a hog, because he has knowledge. A devotee has knowledge. He has knowledge of what his position is, what his relationship with Krishna is. Even though he may not be completely realized, but yet he has that knowledge. He knows, at least intellectually, or some bit of him, he knows that he is not his body. And material happiness, like the pigs, will not satisfy him. So the devotee, when he feels those pinchings of material nature, the pangs of suffering, he sees that as Krishna's kindness to him, to give him impetus to go higher, to become the transcendentalist and become happy on that level, because he has too much knowledge to jump into the gutter with the pig. And sometimes being covered by illusion, when the modes of material nature are very, very strong, sometimes we have that temptation even to jump into the gutter and become completely covered by illusion and try to enjoy like that. But it's but that knowledge is an eternal gift, and it actually will never be lost. So when those pinchings come of the miseries of material nature, it forces us to make a choice, because we don't like the suffering. No one likes the suffering. So it forces us to make the choice to either escape the suffering by going down, which we know is no solution, or to exalt ourselves in Krishna consciousness by perfecting our devotional service, hard as it may be. Why is it hard? Because we are still trapped by the modes of material nature. We still have attachments in the material world. We still love things in the material world, although they are actually the source of our misery, not the source of our pleasure. By definition, every material thing causes suffering, even though superficially it may cause pleasure. Because those things that cause pleasure are temporary. And when you have something that is giving you pleasure and it's going to stop giving you pleasure at some point, either by the death of your loved one or by the fact that how many ice creams can you eat in one day, and that it's gonna, the pleasure that it gives is going to turn to suffering at some time. So built in to the material world is suffering by Krishna's mercy. So we have impetus to come up higher in Krishna consciousness. And the alternative to coming up higher in Krishna consciousness is abominable. It is going down into the hog-like existence and trying to find happiness in that way. And we should not do that. Due to our attachments, as we said, that tendency may be there to try to find happiness. That is due to the mode of passion. We should avoid the mode of passion. And we'll get to that point at the end of the third chapter. We'll begin sailing in the ocean of the third chapter very soon. And then maybe tomorrow, maybe today, but maybe most likely tomorrow we'll reach the shore of the third chapter, which explains about this great enemy in the form of the mode of passion, which transforms, which gives birth to lust or material desires, which ultimately cause misery for us. So we heard very briefly about the second chapter. We skimmed through that quite quickly. It's worth days and days of its own, but we couldn't do that. But in the third chapter, after Arjuna on the battlefield looks over the armies and Krishna instructs him on so many things, one time I listed the different topics that Krishna instructs Arjuna, or at least touches on in the third chapter, and there's 13 very heavy and philosophical topics, maybe not 13, but there's quite a few. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 12 or so, 13, 15. Very heavy philosophical topics. And Arjuna could not grasp everything. Especially, he could not understand how Krishna was encouraging him. In the 71st verse of the second chapter, Krishna says, a person who has given up all desires for sense gratification, who lives free from desires, who has given up this all sense of proprietorship, of ownership, thinking this is mine, free from all desires, and is devoid of false ego, he alone can attain real peace. So there is Arjuna in the middle of the battlefield, and above all else, what does he want? He wants peace because he doesn't want to fight in the battle. So he's hearing Krishna say, give up all desires, give up all false ego, and there he is going after kill to gain the kingdom. So he becomes somewhat bewildered. He cannot get all the perspective of the philosophy of what Krishna is saying. And Krishna has told him, as we mentioned again and again, is Dharena Yavaram Karma Buddhi Yogam Dhananjaya, that you should take all abominable activities and keep them far away from you through Buddhi, intelligence. So naturally Arjuna wants to use his intelligence to avoid the fighting. And therefore he asks Krishna in the beginning of the chapter, O Janardana, Jana Ardana. Jana means person, and Ardana, there are many meanings of it, but one of them is one who gives trouble. So Arjuna calls Krishna Janardana. Are you giving me trouble? I'm a person, and are you giving me trouble now? Oh, Keshava. Keshava means the one who controls even Brahma and Shiva. You're the controller of everything, and yet I can't understand what I'm supposed to do. Why do you want me to engage in this ghastly warfare where millions of people are going to be killed? Why do you want me to do that if you think that intelligence or Buddhi is better than fruit of work or karma? Why should I fight, engage in karma, if intelligence is better? Look at the result. It's going to be horrible. My intelligence is bewildered, Arjuna says, by your equivocal instructions. Actually, Krishna has not given equivocal two instructions of equal weight. He has not given that at all. He has explained jnana, knowledge that we are not our body, and he has explained karma, how to act actually on that level. And he's also explained karma, how to act selfishly. He's actually explained a few things. But Arjuna doesn't understand. He doesn't see the different levels that Krishna is explaining, and therefore he says, please tell me decisively what will be most beneficial. Tell me what I should do. Tell me one thing to do. Just one thing, not two. Use your intelligence and yet fight. Not two things. Tell me one thing. So he says, Tare kam vananischitya. Tare kam. Tell me one thing. So Krishna begins instructing Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, O sinless Arjuna, I have already explained that there are two classes of men who try to realize the self. Some are inclined to understand it by empirical philosophical speculation, which means gyan, which means renunciation, and the others by devotional service or karma yoga by activity. So actually, Arjuna has misunderstood that Krishna has spoken of two things. Actually, Krishna has spoken of one thing, a process, which Prabhupada will call in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the yoga ladder. We'll hear something about the different stages of progress in devotional service. And Krishna has actually explained two different stages of the same thing. Because all religion and all activities in human life are actually meant to climb this yoga ladder. And this is actually the purpose of human life, to make advancement in spiritual life. If we cannot attain the lotus feet of Krishna, according to the Vedic culture, all at once, but at least we should go higher, advance further. At least we should make use of our human life to advance further, not degrade ourselves into hog-like existence. So Krishna has actually explained two stages of the same thing, this advancement in Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada explains that in the, his purport. And then in text 4, some very interesting philosophy begins, which goes on throughout this section, which goes on for about 13 verses. And we'll go over that, and then we'll start some other interesting things. Especially we'll describe the beginnings of the yoga ladder, and why Krishna, and why in the Vedic scriptures different things are preached at different times. Sometimes it will say, worship Lord Shiva. In the Shiva Purana it will say that. In a different Purana it will say, worship Lord Brahma or Lord Vishnu. And then in the Upanishads it said, forget all that and just try to cultivate knowledge. And finally in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna will say, Vedes Charsavar Aham Eva Vidyo. By all the Vedic knowledge, I am to be known. So the different stages are instructed differently by Krishna according to what a person needs. So this will begin that study after these 13 verses are completed. But these 13 verses are very interesting and they are very important. There is a principle that is clearly explained here that is of the essence of our spiritual life, and therefore we should understand it very clearly. In text 4, Krishna explains, not by merely abstaining from work can one achieve freedom from reaction, nor by renunciation alone can one attain perfection. Because Arjuna is on the battlefield, and he doesn't want to get the sins, the reactions from all the killing. So one who is intelligent in this world, he understands that everything he does, this is the law of karma, will have some reaction to it. Every step I take even, there's some killing involved. Every breath I take, I'm killing some living entities. Every transaction in business, I'm trying to take more than I give. And every dealing, there is some reaction, either good or bad. So therefore, impersonalists especially, or even a natural tendency of the living entity when he's in a frustrating situation is to want to give up work completely, to become renounced from work, to avoid the frustration that work causes, and secondarily to avoid the reactions that come with every good and bad thing that we do. So Mayavadis say, the impersonalists, they say if you want to take the spiritual life, you cannot be a householder, you cannot work, have a job, perform any prescribed duties. If you want to be a spiritualist, you have to give up all material work. Give it up completely. Stop. You cannot work for your food. You cannot work, you cannot be with your family. That is all karma. It will entangle you in material life. give it up completely. You have to take sannyas. And sannyas means nyas, renunciation, giving up all work. This is the philosophy of the impersonalists. Because, again, they're trying to avoid karma. So Krishna is speaking immediately against that concept. Not by merely abstaining from work can one achieve freedom from reaction. The results of karma will come. Even if you give up work superficially, nor by renunciation alone can one attain perfection. Now, why is this not the way to get free from reactions? Why? The next verse explains this very essential point. Everyone is forced to act helplessly according to the qualities he has acquired from the modes of material nature. Therefore, no one can refrain from doing something, not even for a moment. Prabhupada explains in the purport, it is not a question of embodied life, but is the nature of the soul to be always active. And the proof of this is, as soon as the soul leaves the body, and if any of you have seen at the moment of passing of the soul from the body in any creature, whether it's a pigeon or a human being, the moment the soul passes, there is the thing that it's immediately perceived that it's gone, first of all. There is a hollowness in the eyes. But what can one say? The body immediately looks dead. And before, a moment before, the body looked alive. And the essence of what, of course, the consciousness is gone, and the soul is gone, and the consciousness is gone, but all activity is immediately gone from the body, and it's a dead body. That transformation from a live body to a dead body itself is astounding. Actually, the body was never alive. It is the soul that's alive. The body is always dead, like a car is always dead. It appears to be alive when someone is in the car driving it. But the life doesn't belong to the car. It never does. It never had. So similarly, this body is a vehicle. Only. And as soon as the soul leaves, the body ceases all activity. Because the soul is active by nature and there's nothing that we can do about it. We are active. We see this. Just try and be inactive for a second. You cannot. Someone will move. Everyone will move. Your mind will move. Or it's scratched like this. Very it's so unnatural to be inactive. Completely unnatural, because it's the soul that is active. It is the quality of the soul. So when the soul is acting badly, improperly, entangled in the material world, to stop it, to try to stop it from acting improperly by stopping it from all activity, is impossible. So therefore, one cannot attain perfection by abstaining from work and refraining from action. An example that every parent and every teacher knows, and Prabhupada gives it in the Bhagavatam, when a child is acting naughtily, badly, what do you do? If you say, stop acting badly, the child starts going like this. It has to do something because it's active. So what do the parents and the teachers do? You have to engage it in something that is not naughty, that is good for it. And that's actually the greatest punishment, practically speaking, you can give to a child, is you sit there and do nothing. Or an adult, you sit there and do nothing. You sit there with your hands folded at your desk or something and just do nothing. We used to, in high school, that was the detention system that we used to have. When a student was bad, you'd have to sit for an hour after class and do nothing. It's a punishment because the nature of the soul is active. Now, if the soul is acting badly within the body, he's not acting as a soul, he's acting, what is he acting as? So this verse explains, and it's going to explain later, Krishna will explain later, that we are covered, controlled by modes of material nature. This is explained, this is another important topic in the Bhagavad Gita, explained in the 14th chapter, in the 17th chapter, in the 18th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that there are three modes of material nature: goodness, passion, and ignorance. And we are controlled by different combinations of those modes. If we are not serving Krishna, if we are not free from material nature, if we are not engaged naturally in our real life, the real life of the soul, then we are forced, we are under the control of different combinations of goodness, passion, and ignorance. Goodness and passion, ignorance. So all living entities are under the control to some degree or another of these different modes and are forced to act. That activity of the soul comes out according to the modes of material nature. Just like if we have a light, we can take, there's the natural energy of the light bulb, which is the light coming out. But we can put a red filter, that's like the mode of passion, and we can say the light is a red light. But actually the light is clear, it's just the filter that is red. Or a blue, which is the mode of ignorance. Or yellow, which is the mode of goodness. And different combinations of those primary, those aren't the primary colors, are they? There's green also. Anyway, those three colors, different combinations. So that is like the different, and we are all souls, and our business is to love Krishna and serve Krishna with great devotion. But rejecting that path, anadiya bahimukh, we have turned our back on Krishna. We are forced to be active either in goodness, passion, and ignorance, like the light, the different shades or tones coming from the light. But we cannot stop acting. That is not one of the choices that we have. We have to act. It is our nature. So therefore, everyone is forced to act helplessly. Helplessly. It is not in our control. Helplessly. We are forced to act. It is the nature of the soul. And therefore, if one is not completely purified, if all the coverings of the light are not removed, or most of them are not removed, if he tries to give up activity, he will not be able to act properly in spiritual life. Rather, he will be forced to act according to the modes of material nature. Someone who prematurely gives up activity, working hard, It will not be able to work purely in Krishna's loving service in the spiritual world, which is the true natural activity of the soul. He will not be able to engage there in Vrindavan. He will not be able to do it because he's still covered by goodness, passion, or ignorance. So therefore, what will happen is he'll have no way to vent his activity purely. He cannot act on that level, and he'll be like just trying to restrain himself. His tendency will be to work according to the modes of nature, goodness, passion, ignorance, which affect him. And he'll be always trying to restrain himself and fighting this nature. Because he's given up all work. He has to be inactive on the material platform. This is the sannyas that the Mayavadis do. And therefore he is tortured. And therefore what happens is first his mind will start dwelling on good things of the modes of material nature, especially the dealings between men and women. Even though he's supposed to be a renowned sadhu living in the forest doing nothing but nirjan bhajan, staying alone and just chanting hundreds of rounds every day, or just studying Vedanta or meditating on Brahman, depending upon his what path he is on. But he will not be able to do that at all. He will be forced by these modes of material nature. They will force their way for him to act on the material platform, and he will get himself into the greatest trouble. And therefore, in text 6, one who restrains the senses of action, this is especially talking about these Mayavadis and Brahmavadis, sannyasis, who give up work prematurely under the philosophy of they don't want to engage in karma and get reactions. So they give up work, they restrain the senses of action, but their mind dwells on sense objects, and they think that they are advanced, and therefore they are deluding themselves, and they are called pretenders. Mithyachar is the word that Krishna uses. Mithyachar means false, and achar means activity. He's a fake, a pretender, one who is engaging in false activity. And Prabhupada explains in the purport, actually to the next verse, where he explains it's better to engage your senses actively. In text 7, if a sincere person, rather than giving up work and falsely making believe we are exalted, great spiritual personalities and living in the forest, etc., etc., and putting on a show for a very short period of time, and while the mind is just... one devotee was telling the story about there was an ISKCON devotee who... associated with some Babaji's from Navadvip. He was a Gurukula teacher, actually. And he left ISKCON thinking that he was going to become an exalted personality. He gave up his work, his service, and he went and just became a preacher of the Bhagavatam. And then later on, he went to Radhakund, the most exalted place in Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy. He went there and he became very renounced for a while. And then one day he came to Vrindavan, and he saw one of the Gurukula teachers, and there he was, a Babaji. And he said to his old friend, another Gurukula teacher, "There is something I'd like, have a favor of you, but you won't be able to guess what it is." And the Gurukula teacher said, "You want a Time magazine, don't you?" And he said, "How did you know?" Because you can't keep yourself aloof like that from the modes of material nature. You can't make believe you're transcendental anymore, that from now on sometimes I'll read something in the Bhagavatam about the glories of the constant chanting of the holy name, and I'll say from now on I'm only going to chant Hare Krishna 24 hours a day. I'm never going to forget Krishna. I'm always going to remember Krishna. Have any of you ever thought like that, or is it only me? But how long does it last for you?
1-2 days.
Oh, good. That's about, I last about 3 seconds usually before I ask again. But anyway, that you can't do it unless you actually have that. Unless you're completely uncovered. You just can't do it. And what happens is, if you're artificially in that position, you cause yourself so much trouble, the mind will, because you can't engage your senses. And that is one of the most glorious things that Prabhupada did through ISKCON. He's built a society which is so preaching oriented that everything in the material world can be engaged in the service of the preaching movement. That means that unlimited people, no matter what their tendencies are, can use their active senses in the service of Krishna. So how glorious is Prabhupada's contribution, fulfilling the desire, deeply understanding the desire of Srila Rupa Goswami, who knows Sri Chaitanya Manavistam, he knows the mind of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Krishna sambandhe, nirbandha Krishna sambandhe, yukta vairagya uchate. The real renunciation is to use everything in Krishna's service. And ISKCON, this is one of the glories of the ISKCON Krishna Conscious Movement, It's the use of the computers, the money, the cars, the this, the that, the everything, the slide projectors, the tape recorders. Everything, everything can be used in Krishna's service. Again, that means that unlimited people, whatever anyone does, from the farmer to the computer technologist to the artist, everyone can be practice this karma yoga that Krishna is going to explain. And imagine the scholar, anyone, the writer, anyone. But imagine how difficult it would be if everyone had to become a monk and just give up their tendencies and just chant Hare Krishna 24 hours. For us, it would be very, very difficult, even though that's the goal and the essence of all advice. So to use the active senses in the service of Krishna, this is glorious. And that, the process, the result of doing that, will bring us to the ultimate platform where we can actually live a fully pure spiritual life as souls on that platform and actually be engaged in the service, in Krishna's service in Vrindavan. But if we try to prematurely do that, it means doom. And this is exactly, will become mityachar, like the Mayavadis. So again, I'd like to just go over this point that we must be active. And this is how devotion, why do we say that devotional service is easy to perform? Because it takes the senses, which are, in one sense, they're the connection with Maya. Because the senses are the means of enjoyment. So it takes those senses, which are compared to poisonous snakes, it allows us to take those senses and use them just as strongly as if we were a selfishly controlled materialist. We can use them completely, our senses, we can use them completely in Krishna's service. And we will become purified. And if we didn't have that ability, what would we do? We could not give up activity. We are not pure enough to engage in pure spiritual activity. We would be lost. The soul must be active. He cannot act on the spiritual platform. He cannot give up activity. So to use the senses in Krishna's service is glorious, and to engage others in the use of their senses in Krishna's service is glorious for us and glorious for them and for the spreading of Krishna consciousness. How practical and easy is the system of bhakti yoga that Krishna is going to explain when we get through these 13 verses. I'll start at the very beginning because every journey begins with a small step. So some of these small steps we have passed already. Maybe in this life, maybe 10 lives ago, maybe hundreds of lives ago, we have taken the first steps. And now all of us are at our own advancement, having been on this path for maybe many, 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 many lives. Or maybe this is our first. So we're on that, we're somewhere. So when we hear the whole progression as Krishna describes it, especially these first principal steps, then we can understand where we are, and we can understand how to engage others. Like the doctor who can take the pulse, the expert doctor, the Ayurvedic physician, they just take the pulse of the patient and can understand the exact nature of the disease, and therefore they can prescribe. They understand where his health is, where his strength is, where his weakness is, and then they can prescribe. So similarly, you have to know all the elements of health and disease to be able to prescribe properly. So similarly, when we know the whole progression from completely absorbed in material life to the pinnacle of spiritual life, then we can, when we are teaching, when our business is to teach, we can understand where another person's situation is and give him the exact right medicine that he needs to take him to the next step of health. So therefore, Krishna says in text 7, on the other hand, rather than trying to renounce the use of the senses because of fear of becoming engaged in karma, on the other hand, if a sincere person tries to control the active senses by the mind, and the mind by the intelligence, and the intelligence by the Bhagavad Gita, then one will begin karma yoga in Krishna consciousness without attachment. He is superior to the person who has given up work. It's better to work with detachment. This is actually Krishna's, this is the basic principle of our preaching to congregation, to the people of the world. Yes, work, but don't be attached. Karma eva dikaris te mapale shukadachana. That you have a right to do your work, but don't take the fruit of your work